A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the boulders of Mansfield, Connecticut. You know, those massive granite lumps just sitting in people's front yards. Some of them painted to look like cows or sheep. He's asking what these rocks actually are, geologically speaking, and how they've shaped what he calls the Connecticut mentality. The fairs, the folklore, the way a town builds its identity around things that refuse to move.
This is one of those questions where the geology and the culture are so tangled up you can't really pull them apart. And Mansfield is the perfect case study because it's got more of these things per square mile than almost anywhere else in the state.
That's what they look like from a drone. Just these gray-pink lumps scattered across suburban lawns like a herd that got caught mid-graze and never unfroze.
Some of them are literally painted like cows. There's one on Route 44 with black spots and a tail. But to understand why these rocks matter, we need to start with what they actually are, and why there are so many of them in this one town.
Let's do that. What am I looking at when I'm standing in front of one of these things?
You're looking at a glacial erratic, a boulder that was ripped from bedrock somewhere far away, carried by the Laurentide ice sheet, and dumped here when the ice retreated about 18,000 years ago. But not all erratics are the same. Mansfield's boulders are predominantly something called Mansfield granite, which is geologically distinct from what you'd find in surrounding towns.
I assume that's not just a branding exercise by the local tourism board.
It's a real geological formation, medium to coarse-grained biotite granite. The defining feature is these pink feldspar crystals, microcline specifically, that give the boulders this distinctive rosy hue when they catch the light. Compositionally, we're talking about 30 to 35% quartz, 25 to 30% microcline feldspar, and 15 to 20% biotite mica. That pink feldspar is the giveaway. You drive through Mansfield, you see a boulder with a pinkish cast, you know it's local.
This is different from what you'd find in, say, Bolton or Coventry.
Those towns sit on Bolton schist, much darker, more metamorphic, more layered. Mansfield's erratics are granite, which is igneous, which means they weather differently. They're more resistant to erosion, which is why they've been sitting there for 18 millennia looking more or less the same, while softer rocks around them wore down to soil.
The ice sheet basically picked up a very specific batch of rock from somewhere and dropped it here like a delivery.
The Willimantic River Valley acted as a kind of glacial debris chute. During the retreat, meltwater funneled through that valley, concentrating the debris flow. That's why Mansfield has roughly 4.2 erratics per square mile, compared to the Connecticut state average of 1. That number comes from the 2023 Connecticut Geological Survey, and it's striking, more than double the state average.
2 per square mile. Some towns would kill for that kind of erratic density.
I don't know if they'd kill for it, but Mansfield has certainly built an identity around it. And it's not just the quantity, it's the size. Many of these boulders are over 6 feet in diameter. Some are the size of small houses. They're impossible to ignore.
Which is where the culture starts. You can't ignore something that's been sitting in your front yard since before your ancestors existed. So you name it. You tell stories about it. You hold fairs on it.
That's exactly what happened. The rocks have names. Pudding Rock, the Giant's Marbles, Hannah's Rock. They became meeting points. Before GPS, before street signs, you'd say, "Meet me at the big boulder by the old mill road," and everyone knew which one you meant. Pre-colonial populations used them as territorial markers and gathering sites. Colonial settlers used them as property boundaries. You can't move them, so they make perfect survey markers.
A survey marker that weighs 40 tons. Nobody's going to dispute that property line.
That permanence is the psychological thread here. When you live among objects that have been unmoved for 18,000 years, it does something to how you think about change, about what you can control, and what you have to work around.
The Connecticut Stoicism thing.
We'll get there. But first, let's get specific about what makes a Mansfield boulder different from a random rock in someone's backyard. The answer starts with that pink crystal.
So, we've got this very specific granite, dumped in unusual concentrations by a glacial debris chute, sitting around for 18,000 years. At what point do people start treating them as community assets, rather than just large inconveniences?
The documented shift starts in the 1870s. There were these informal gatherings called Boulder Day. People would picnic around the largest erratics, kids would climb them, there'd be music. It was partly practical. In an era before air conditioning, these massive rocks stay cool, so they created natural gathering spots in summer. But it was also genuinely celebratory.
A rock party.
A rock party. And it evolved. In 1972, the town formalized it into the Mansfield Rock Fair, held annually on the third Saturday of September at what's called the Great Boulder Field on Route 44. That's a 3-acre field with 11 major erratics, the largest of which weighs an estimated 180 tons.
People show up for this.
In 2025, the fair drew 3,200 attendees. They had a boulder balancing competition. A 17-year-old won it by balancing a 40-pound rock on top of a 200-pound erratic. There's a rock painting contest for kids, geology talks from UConn professors, guided walks. It's a real community institution. Been running for over 50 years now.
A 17-year-old balancing a 40-pound rock on a 200-pound erratic. That's either deeply impressive or a metaphor for something I can't quite articulate.
It's both. And the fair is just the most visible part. The deeper layer is the folklore. And this is where it gets fascinating, because the folklore in Mansfield isn't just made-up stories. Some of it has a measurable physical basis.
You're talking about the Wandering Stone.
This is a specific boulder, about 14 feet long, 8 feet wide, sitting on a sloped clay bed near the Willimantic River. The legend says it moves 3 inches every year toward the river. And here's the thing, it's been measured across 109 years.
Walk me through those measurements.
First documentation was in 1892 by a Reverend Silas Kay. He was a local minister and amateur naturalist who noticed the boulder's position relative to a fixed stone wall seemed to have shifted since his childhood. He drove stakes and measured. He documented a 3-inch shift from where his father had marked the boulder's position 40 years earlier. In 1934, a WPA survey team, this was during the Depression, the Works Progress Administration was doing all kinds of local documentation projects. They measured it again and found it had moved 2.9 inches per year relative to Hatch's stakes. Then in 2001, a UConn geology team used GPS and found 2.7 inches of annual movement.
It's actually moving. The legend is true.
The movement is real. The explanation is contested. The most likely mechanism is frost heave. Water in the clay soil freezes and expands, lifting the boulder slightly, and when it thaws, the boulder settles just a little further downslope. Combine that with groundwater flow lubricating the clay substrate, and you get this slow, incremental creep. The consistency of the measurements, 3 inches, 2.9 inches, 2.7 inches, strongly supports a physical mechanism rather than measurement error or wishful thinking.
People want it to be something more.
Of course they do. A rock that moves on its own is a better story than a rock being nudged by freeze-thaw cycles. The 2001 measurement made local news, and the Hartford Courant ran a piece with the headline, Mansfield's Wandering Stone, Science Meets Legend. The UConn team was careful to say the movement was real, but the cause was natural. The town, meanwhile, put up a small interpretive sign that says, The Wandering Stone, moving toward the river since the Ice Age. They're happy to let the ambiguity sit.
That's very Connecticut. Acknowledging the science while preserving the mystery.
That's exactly the mentality we're talking about. There's a cultural preference for letting things be what they are. The rock moves. We can measure it. We can debate why. But we're not going to resolve it definitively, and we're not going to stop telling the story.
The Wandering Stone becomes this perfect encapsulation of how Mansfield relates to its boulders, part data, part legend, entirely unwilling to pick one over the other.
It's not the only named erratic with a story. There's Pudding Rock, which supposedly looks like a giant plum pudding. It doesn't, but the name stuck from the 1840s. There's the Giant's Marbles, a cluster of 5 nearly spherical boulders that local lore claims were dropped by a giant playing a game. There's Whisper Rock, where if you sit in a specific crevice and speak, the acoustics create this strange echo that 19th century teenagers used to convince each other was a ghost.
Whisper Rock. Sounds like the title of a YA novel that accidentally becomes a bestseller.
It really does. But the point is, these aren't just geological features with names. They're active participants in community life. People get engaged at Pudding Rock. Kids have birthday parties at the Great Boulder Field. There's a wedding venue in Mansfield that markets itself specifically on having a ceremony boulder, a flat-topped erratic where couples exchange vows.
The Rock is wedding efficient. That's a new one.
It works commercially. Boulder tourism in Mansfield generates an estimated $1.2 million annually, according to the 2025 Town Economic Impact Study. That's the Rock Fair, guided geology walks, a niche market for Mansfield granite countertops, which are quarried from non-erratic sources, by the way, but branded for the association, and this whole ecosystem of rock-themed merchandise.
Mansfield granite countertops. The geological equivalent of naming a subdivision after the forest you bulldozed to build it.
There's absolutely some irony there. But it speaks to how deeply the identity has been absorbed. People want a piece of Mansfield's geological story in their kitchen.
Alright, so we've got unique geology, a concentration anomaly, a fair measurable folklore, and a tourism economy. But you mentioned something earlier about zoning law. What does a boulder have to do with local governance?
This is where things get really interesting. In 1986, a developer bought a parcel of land that contained a boulder called Hannah's Rock, named after a woman named Hannah Stoddard, who, according to local records, used it as a meeting point during the Revolutionary War to pass information to Patriot forces.
It had historical significance beyond just being large.
Significant enough that when the developer announced plans to blast it and clear the land for a subdivision, the Mansfield Historical Society sued. They invoked the Connecticut Environmental Protection Act, arguing the boulder was a cultural landmark. The legal battle lasted 14 months. The developer argued it was just a rock. The Historical Society argued it was heritage.
The court bought the heritage argument?
The court ruled that Hannah's Rock qualified as a cultural landmark under the Act. The developer was required to redesign the foundation around it. The resulting house has a boulder protruding through the living room floor. It's sealed and finished. It's basically an architectural feature now.
A boulder in the living room. That's either a conversation piece or a constant reminder that you lost a lawsuit.
But the real legacy of that case was legislative. In 1987, Mansfield passed Zoning Code Section 4.3, which requires developers to design building foundations around existing boulders over 6 feet in diameter. You can't blast them. You can't remove them. You have to work with them.
That's extraordinary. The town literally codified the rocks into law.
It changed the economics of development. Properties with named erratics now sell for an average of 8% more than comparable properties without, according to the 2024 Mansfield property tax assessment data. The boulders went from being obstacles to assets. Developers started marketing boulder-inclusive lots. The thing that was going to cost you money to remove now adds value.
It's like the town collectively decided that permanence has value. That there's something worth preserving about an object that was here before us and will be here after us.
That's the Connecticut Stoicism we keep circling. It's not a stereotype. It's a genuine cultural adaptation to a landscape that refuses to accommodate you. When you can't move the rock, you learn to build around it. That becomes a metaphor. It becomes how you think about problems. You don't expect the world to reshape itself for your convenience. You work with what's there.
There's something almost Japanese about that. The concept of working with natural features rather than imposing on them.
It's a parallel worth drawing, but Mansfield's version is distinctly New England. It's less aesthetic and more pragmatic. It's not about creating beauty, though that happens. It's about acknowledging that some things are simply not going to change, and your options are to fight them and lose, or to incorporate them and thrive.
Build around it. That's a 3-word summary of an entire regional psychology.
It shows up in the architecture beyond just foundations. There's a whole Boulder aesthetics movement in Mansfield. From 2019 to 2024, an artist named Maria Lopez led the Boulder Bench Project. 12 carved granite seating areas installed along the Mansfield Hollow Trail, each made from a fallen erratic, each inscribed with a line from Wallace Stevens' poem, The Rock.
Connecticut's own. He worked in Hartford as an insurance executive while writing some of the most important American poetry of the 20th century.
The Rock is a perfect choice. It's a late poem, meditative, about the ground of being, literally and metaphorically. The project cost $240,000, funded by a Connecticut Arts Council grant. Each bench is different because each erratic is different. Lopez carved them to follow the natural contours of the stone.
You're walking the trail. You sit on a $240,000 granite bench carved from an Ice Age boulder and inscribed with modernist poetry. That's not what most people picture when they think of a town hiking trail.
That's Mansfield. It's a town of about 26,000 people, home to Yukon, and it has this completely outsized relationship with its rocks. The Boulder Walk is a self-guided tour covering 14 named erratics in a 3-mile loop. You can pick up a map at the Mansfield Public Library, or there's an app. It's actually called Mansfield Rocks, that guides you from the Great Boulder Field to Hannah's Rock and back.
The pun was inevitable.
It really was. But the app is useful. It has GPS coordinates, historical notes, the geological composition of each boulder, and for the Wandering Stone, it includes the measurement history.
How does this compare to other places that have built culture around rocks? I'm thinking of the Black Hills, the Lakota Stone People traditions, or those glacial erratics in Sweden they turned into rune stones.
The comparison is instructive precisely because it highlights what's unique about Mansfield. The Lakota tradition treats certain stones as spiritual beings. The stone people are considered the oldest relatives present at creation. Swedish rune stones are erratics that were intentionally carved with inscriptions during the Viking Age. Their rocks turned into monuments. Mansfield doesn't do either of those things. The boulders aren't worshipped, and they aren't carved into monuments, the Boulder Bench Project notwithstanding, and even that preserves the natural form.
They're just, but also celebrated.
They're celebrated for being exactly what they are. There's a humility in that. The rock doesn't need to be carved into a monument. It's already monumental by virtue of being a 180-ton granite boulder that's been sitting in the same spot since the glaciers melted.
The monument is the fact of its existence.
That's the Connecticut mentality in a sentence. You don't need to add anything. The thing itself is enough.
There's another comparison. Rock City in upstate New York. That's a more commercialized version of this, right?
Rock City is fascinating, but it's a very different phenomenon. It's a specific geological formation of conglomerate rock that looks like a city skyline, and it's been a tourist attraction since the late 1800s, with admission fees, gift shops, the whole thing. Mansfield's boulder culture is distributed across the town. It's not a single attraction you pay to see. It's woven into the fabric of daily life. You see boulders in people's yards. You pass them on your commute. They're part of the zoning code.
The zoning code is really the key difference. Rock City is a destination. Mansfield's boulders are infrastructure. Cultural infrastructure. Legal infrastructure.
That's why the Hannah's Rock case matters so much. It wasn't just about saving one rock. It established a legal framework that treats these boulders as having standing. They're not property, they're features of the landscape that the community has an interest in preserving. That's a radical idea, legally speaking.
A rock has standing. The mind recoils slightly, but the precedent is there.
It's been influential. Since 1990, 7 other Connecticut towns have adopted similar natural feature preservation ordinances, using Mansfield's Section 4.3 as a template. The language varies, but the core principle is the same. Certain geological features are worth more intact than removed.
What does this mean for someone who's not in Connecticut? Is there a takeaway beyond Mansfield has interesting rocks?
I think there are 2 practical takeaways. First, if you're visiting Mansfield, the Boulder Walk is worth doing. It's a 3-mile loop, 14 named erratics, you can do it in an afternoon. Start at the Great Boulder Field on Route 44, end at Hannah's Rock, download the Mansfield Rocks app. The 3rd Saturday of September is the Rock Fair if you want the full experience. Check your own local zoning codes for natural feature preservation ordinances. Most people have no idea whether their town has anything like Section 4 Mansfield's ordinances available online at the town clerk's website, and it's been used as a model. If you live somewhere with distinctive geological features, glacial erratics, old-growth trees, unique rock formations, there's a framework for protecting them that doesn't require them to be designated as historic landmarks or parks. They can just be preserved as features of the landscape.
The idea that a zoning code can encode a community's relationship with its physical environment is powerful. Most people think of zoning as a bureaucratic nuisance, setbacks, height limits, parking requirements. But Section 4.3 is zoning as a statement of values.
That's what makes Mansfield's story transferable. Every town has something, maybe not boulders, but some physical feature that defines the landscape. The question is whether the community has recognized it and decided to protect it. Mansfield did, and it took a 14-month legal battle and a boulder in someone's living room to make it happen.
The boulder in the living room is such a perfect image. You can't ignore it. It's literally in your house. You have to vacuum around an Ice Age erratic.
I wonder what the resale value is on that house. 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, and a cultural landmark in the living room.
8% premium, apparently.
Right. The data supports it. But I wonder if there's a subset of buyers who would pay extra specifically for the story. This is the house where the developer lost.
There's definitely a market for that. The Schadenfreude premium.
The developer, to his credit, eventually leaned into it. The house was completed in 1988, and when he listed it, the real estate listing actually mentioned the boulder as a feature. Unique architectural element, natural granite formation incorporated into living space.
Unique architectural element. The real estate euphemism for we couldn't blast it, so now it's decor.
That's exactly the adaptation we're talking about. He couldn't move the rock, so he built around it and then he sold it as a feature. That's Connecticut Stoicism in a microcosm.
Let's talk about the psychological dimension more directly. You've mentioned Connecticut Stoicism a few times. What's the evidence that living among these boulders actually shapes mentality, rather than just providing a convenient metaphor?
That's a fair question, and I should be careful here. I'm not aware of a controlled psychological study comparing residents of high erratic density towns to low erratic density towns. The evidence is cultural and historical rather than experimental. But there's a consistent pattern in how Mansfield's community decisions get made. The zoning code is one example. The town's approach to Yukon expansion is another. Mansfield has consistently pushed for the university to grow within existing footprints rather than sprawling into new areas. The comprehensive plan emphasizes preservation and adaptation over transformation.
It's less rocks make you stoic, and more a community that values permanence expresses that value through its rocks, and then the rocks reinforce the value.
That's a better way to put it. It's a feedback loop. The boulders are a tangible reminder that some things don't yield to human intention. You grow up seeing these massive stones in your neighbor's yards. You hear the story of Hannah's Rock. You go to the rock fair as a kid, and you absorb the idea that working with what's there is better than trying to erase it.
That's different from, say, a Midwestern farming community where the landscape has been completely transformed. The prairie is gone. The grid of fields is human imposed. There's a different psychology there. The land is something you shape to your will.
New England's glacial landscape resists that. The soil is thin and rocky. The boulders are too massive to move without industrial equipment. And even then, where would you put them? The landscape imposes constraints, and the culture adapts to those constraints. The Connecticut mentality isn't about passivity. It's about recognizing which battles are worth fighting.
Choose your battles as geological destiny.
I'd say choose your battles as geological influence, not destiny. The rocks don't determine everything, but they nudge. They create a set of default assumptions about how the world works.
What happens when climate change starts messing with those assumptions? You mention frost heave as the mechanism for the wandering stone. If freeze-thaw cycles accelerate, does the stone move faster?
That's actually an open question, and it's one that a Yukon geologist named Dr. Elena Vasquez has proposed studying. She's seeking funding for a 5-year monitoring project that would track the wandering stone's movement with high-precision GPS and correlate it with temperature and precipitation data. If frost heave is the mechanism and climate change increases the frequency of freeze-thaw cycles in Connecticut winters, the stone could accelerate.
The wandering stone might start wandering faster. That's almost poetic. Climate change written in the movement of a single boulder.
It would be a measurable local manifestation of a global phenomenon, a 40-ton erratic creeping a little faster toward the Willimantic River each year. It's the kind of data point that makes climate change tangible in a way that global temperature averages don't.
The rock is climate indicator. It just keeps accumulating meanings.
That's the thing about these boulders. They're not static, even though they appear to be. They're moving, slowly, through mechanisms we partially understand. They're accumulating stories. They're shaping laws and property values in community festivals. They're geological features that have become cultural actors.
Which brings us back to the Connecticut Bicentennial. You mentioned it in passing. 2026 is the 200th anniversary of...
Connecticut statehood? No, that was 1788. The bicentennial reference is about something more local. Several Connecticut towns are marking bicentennials of their incorporation or specific founding events. The point is, there's a broader re-examination of Connecticut identity happening, and Mansfield's boulders are a tangible anchor for that conversation. When you ask, what does it mean to be from this place? Having a 180-ton granite boulder that's been there for 18,000 years gives you a pretty concrete starting point.
We are the people who built around the rock. That's not a bad founding myth.
It's grounded in something real. It's not a myth in the sense of being fabricated. It's a story that emerges from the physical facts of the landscape and the legal and cultural responses to those facts. The boulders are real. The zoning code is real. The rock fair is real. The wandering stone's measurements are real.
7 inches per year is real. I keep coming back to that. Someone actually measured it. Across more than a century.
That's what separates Mansfield's boulder culture from pure folklore. There's a scientific substrate. The stories are built on granite, literally and figuratively.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1900s on Sakhalin Island, a Japanese macaque named Kichi formed an unlikely friendship with a stellar sea eagle, bringing the bird fish scraps every morning for 11 years. A relationship documented by a Russian naturalist who noted the eagle would perch on the macaque's favorite rock and wait for its daily delivery.
A monkey feeding a sea eagle on a rock in Sakhalin. That's somehow the most on-brand fact we've ever had.
I have so many questions about the naturalist who spent 11 years watching this.
So where does this leave us? Mansfield's boulders started as glacial debris and became cultural infrastructure. The question for the future is whether the boulder ethic survives growth. Mansfield's population is projected to increase by about 12% by 2035. More people means more development pressure. More developers looking at a 6-foot erratic and seeing an obstacle rather than an asset.
That tension is real. Three has held for nearly 40 years, but zoning codes can be amended. The legal precedent from Hannah's Rock is strong but not unassailable. The question is whether the cultural value of the boulders is deeply enough embedded to survive a generation that might not have grown up with the rock fair and the wandering stone stories.
Or whether the economic argument, 8% property value premiums, $1-2 million in annual tourism, provides a durable incentive regardless of cultural attachment.
That's the pragmatic case, and it's a strong one. The boulders pay for themselves now. But markets shift. If boulder tourism declined, or if the countertop branding lost its cachet, would the preservation instinct hold? Or would the zoning code start looking like an impediment to growth?
The rocks of Mansfield are not just geological curiosities. They're a mirror for how a community chooses to remember, resist, and adapt. And that mirror is going to get tested.
It already is being tested. Every development proposal that encounters a boulder is a small referendum on what Mansfield wants to be. A town that builds around obstacles, or a town that blasts them and moves on.
I know which version I'd bet on, but I've been wrong before.
The rocks will still be there either way. That's the one thing you can count on.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtob. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Go look at the rocks in your own town. You might be surprised what's been sitting there all along.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.